Welcome once again to our program, Interpreting the Scriptures Through the Ages. This is series number 27. I'm your host, Pastor Emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church in 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the street. And as usual, our wonderful guest is Ron Eldred, who teaches Bible at John Paul II Catholic High. Ron, welcome once again. And we finished our last program with the three series about how Jesus preached and taught orally to the people, the very common way and the only way that was they had in those days. They didn't have writing like we do. And then the second phase, the apostles began to go out after Jesus rose from the dead and ascended back to heaven. Apostles went out and began to teach the message or the good news, and they wrote a few things down, like in hymns and in the liturgies. Way of praying became the way of believing, as the famous quotation says. They wrote some catechisms, creeds especially, like the Apostles' Creed. And then, of course, the third phase was when actually the scriptures started to be written down by the apostle, evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So I think you can help us find out. We've been talking about the difference between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith, which is such a big topic among last couple hundred years of biblical scholars, but a big split came. And when did it come between the Enlightenment and the 19th century German scholars?
Well, it was between the phases 2 and 3. Scholars of the 18th and 19th centuries, several of whom we have thus far considered, believe that the evidence showed, using now their historical critical method, that there was the real Jesus that lived in the early 1st century during phase 1. Who was not the same as the Christ of faith that had developed among his late first century followers during phases 2 and 3. They claim that what we find in the Gospels is not what the real Jesus said and did, but how his later followers interpreted these sayings and actions. And one of their ploys to support their claims was to posit that the four Gospels were written in the late first century and early second century. Which, of course, would mean that they couldn't have been written by eyewitnesses.
And that's what they want to claim.
Yes. We already encountered this type of theorizing in the rationalist or naturalist interpretations of the 18th century, which tried to explain away Jesus' miracles as merely natural events, or the mythological interpretation of David Strauss that we will consider shortly. And as we shall see, even Strauss admitted that this theory would collapse, that his theory would collapse, if it could be proven that eyewitnesses wrote the Bible much earlier. See, he's claiming that they weren't written by eyewitnesses.
Like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yes. The idea behind these rationalist interpretations is that a later generation of Christians simply fabricated the Gospels to suit their own purposes. Some of them honestly believing their creations and others simply lying about it. And such notions undermined or destroyed the faith of countless persons for two centuries, and I might add my own for a while in the 20th century.
That's amazing how ideas have consequences in everyday practical life.
Yes. However, if one knows the presuppositions or preconceptions or the prejudices or whatever you want to call them, of the rationalist and the mythologizers, he or she won't let their theories disturb his or her faith in the truth of the Gospels. The PBC states that in regard to this subject, and that's the Pontifical Biblical Commission that we quoted several times in our last session, quote, "For certain exponents of this method led astray by rationalist prejudices, refuse to admit that there exists a supernatural order, or that a personal God intervenes in the world by revelation, properly so called, or that miracles and prophecies are possible and have actually occurred. There are others who have as their starting point a wrong notion of faith, taking in that faith is indifferent to historical truth and is indeed incompatible with it. Others practically deny a priori, that is, beforehand, the historical value and character of the documents of Revelation. Others, finally, there are who, on the one hand, underestimate the authority which the apostles had as witnesses of Christ and the office and influence which they wielded in the primitive community, whilst, on the other hand, they overestimate the creative capacity of the community itself. All these aberrations are not only opposed to Catholic doctrine, but are also devoid of any scientific foundation and are foreign to the genuine principles of the historical method. End of quote.
Okay, so all these suppositions or theories are trying to question the truth of the Gospels.
Yes.
The veracity or the reliability of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Well, what are other factors behind some of these rationalized or just based on thinking interpretations?
Well, there's at least one other that I'm aware of. What the PBC said would account for the rationalist theories of biblical interpretation of the 18th and 19th centuries. But there is an additional factor that must be considered in regard to the German Lutheran biblical scholars of the 19th century, who, I might add, were tainted by rationalism. Luke Timothy Johnson, an Orthodox Catholic biblical scholar who teaches at Emory University, in his The Future of Catholic Biblical Scholarship, says that the German Lutheran biblical scholars of the 19th century started out with the Lutheran prejudice, or preconception, or presupposition, that developed during the Reformation, that there once existed during the life of Christ a pure form of Christianity, that by the end of the first century had degenerated into the Catholic Church by taking on incrustations of paganism and Judaism. And what he is here referring to is that the church did wisely incorporate into the church certain elements of pagan cultures that were compatible with Christianity, especially elements that dealt with the sacraments and Greek philosophy. I teach courses at the John Paul II where we, you know, go into these the specifics of these kinds of things.
Can you name one thing off the top of your head that would be how the church baptized some pagan practice or ritual, such as like Christmas?
Yeah, that's the one that's come to mind to me. And not only that, but you can see in John's gospel, the fourth gospel, which wasn't written until probably the 90s of the first century. And John, you know, he begins this gospel, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word dwelt among us, something like that. And this is really Greek philosophy. This the Word, the concept of the Word is from the Greek logos or logos. Again, as I said, in fact, I just finished a whole week just explaining that kind of thing to my class in apologetics here about the logos and John.
So it was using
prologue
Greek philosophical thinking to explain who Jesus was.
Yes,
in the beginning was the Word.
And of course, Augustine used a lot of Platonic or Plato's philosophy in trying to understand more deeply Catholic theology. And then, of course, in the 13th century, you find St. Thomas Aquinas using Aristotle and much of his philosophy. In fact, I teach another class at John Paul where we spend the whole first 10 weeks, just looking at St. Thomas Aquinas' use of Aristotle's philosophy to explain and give more depth to and a deeper understanding of Catholic theology.
I'd like to sit in on that class, Rod, if I get some time. I got you off the track there. Christianity, of course, was the fulfillment of Judaism. So obviously there's many traces of Judaism in the Catholic faith, as well as some of the pagan customs that the church baptized.
Well, the church did adopt elements of Judaism that were compatible with Christianity, especially those elements that dealt with law and church structure. After all, as you just suggested, Christianity was the fulfillment of Judaism. And Jesus came not to destroy the law and the prophets of the Old Testament, as he said, of course, in his Sermon on the Mount, but to fulfill them. And in a sense, Jesus kind of had a ready-made church structure when he came into the world and set up his church, the Catholic Church, in the old Jewish system, the Jewish priesthood, the Jewish sacrifices, the Jewish liturgies, which was primarily the Psalms. Many of these things were, you know, almost directly incorporated into the Catholic Church. You know, with a transformation, certainly the sacrifice, he takes the place of the Passover lamb, of course, which was a part of the Old Testament, and in the New Testament, as I said, he takes the place of this Passover lamb.
And he builds on the Ten Commandments, doesn't destroy the Ten Commandments, but he says, I say to you, it was said of old, thou shalt not murder, but then he added another level onto the foundation of the house.
Sure, he clarifies them, he refines them, he perfects them. Yes, in fact, I delivered a talk fairly recently to an RCIA group, but that was one of the major themes, how Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount fulfills the Ten Commandments.
Okay, I think I got you off again. What difference does it make about four evangelists having different accounts of the life and the teachings and the actions of Jesus, which they obviously do have?
Well, I would answer that is, what difference does it make? If the four Gospels aren't perfectly chronologically matched, or that St. Matthew drew on several of Jesus' sermons to compose the Sermon on the Mount, or that St. John drew together several of Jesus' sermons into the last discourse at the Last Supper, I mean, what difference does it make? It is not proven that they did, but so what if they did? What difference does it make that the evangelists tailored their Gospels later to satisfy the needs of their audience? When I read these accounts and many others in the Gospels, I believe that I am reading what the real Jesus of history really said and did, and not some fictional account composed later by the church to suit its needs at the time. And as St. Augustine saw way back in the 4th century, the contradictions and inconsistencies found in the Gospel are only apparent.
Okay, so people continually in these last couple of centuries, the scripture scholars, we're trying to undermine the truth of the gospel by pointing out differences in Matthew, Mark, Luke's account of things, and trying to reconstruct this Christ of faith against the Jesus of history, and saying the Christ of faith really wasn't the Jesus of history.
Yeah, one of the ones they like to pick out is the difference in Matthew and Luke. Genealogy, the genealogy of Jesus. Well, so what? They had different purposes, as you stated in the session before that. Matthew was writing for a Jewish audience primarily, and Luke was writing for a Gentile audience, and so obviously they construct a little bit different genealogies. They had a purpose for doing that.
Okay, well, we're to the next section, which has particular interest for you, Ron, because David Friedrich Strauss had a profound influence on your life when you were in your 20s or so, shaking your faith very strongly.
Well, I was in the Air Force at the time, and I was probably about 20, because I know I was on my way out to California.
And, this is before you were Catholic.
Yes. And yes, I'd been raised in although our family was kind of divided. We had a Catholic side of the family, and then we had, of course, the Protestant side of the family. My mother and my grandmother were both, my grandmother was raised as a Baptist and then later on became a United Brethren. And then United Brethren, of course, you know, fused together with the Methodist, and now they call it, of course, the United Methodist. And my grandmother went there. And my mother, that's where my mother went to church about all of her life, at least, you know, a good part of her life anyway. So I'd been raised in that kind of, you know, setting. And so I had, you know, I had some faith. I had a pretty good foundation.
A traditional biblical setting.
But yeah, biblical stories.
Okay.
You know, I didn't know much about creeds and, you know, doctrines and things of that sort, because Protestants really don't have a lot of those. But I was pretty familiar, you know, with the biblical stories. Well, whatever. I was on the way to California, and I believe, if I recall right, I was riding the bus at that time. I went across by train a couple times, but I think it was by bus. And we stopped at the bus station in St. Louis. I went inside for a break, and there was a books, you know, a book rack there. And so I saw this book, The Life of Jesus. So I thought, well, that'll be a good book to read. So I picked up a copy of it. And I read the book, at least probably half of it, between St. Louis and the Los Angeles area. And basically, I lost what faith I had in that 2,000-mile journey. It was written by a man by the name of David Friedrich Strauss. Of course, I had no idea who Strauss was, and I didn't know that he was a German Lutheran scripture scholar of the early 19th century, a man who basically had lost his faith and who'd written this book using this so-called historical critical method that we'll be looking at a little bit more later on. And the name of the book in German was Leben Jesu. Well, we're going to talk about Strauss, so I'll tell a little bit about
Go ahead and tell us something about Strauss that was such a negative influence in your life.
Well, David Friedrich Strauss, he was a German biblical scholar who lived from 1808 to 1874, and as a boy, he had studied at a Protestant evangelical seminary to prepare for the study of theology. In other words, I take it back, he wasn't a Lutheran. He was probably more of a Calvinist-oriented church. There were, they call them Reformed churches, I believe, in Germany. My wife, who came from not a Lutheran background or not a Catholic background German, but came from this Reformed background before she converted to the Catholic faith earlier in our marriage. But one of his professors was F.C. Bauer, who taught his pupils, quote, a deep love of the ancient classics and the principles of textual criticism. This is historical criticism.
Okay.
Which could be applied to text in the sacred tradition as well as to classical ones, end of quote. We talked a little bit about Bauer and much earlier in this series. In 1825, he entered the University of Tübingen, where he was strongly attracted to Schleiermacher. We spent a whole two sessions at least on Schleiermacher's writings. And during 1830, he served as an assistant clergyman in a country congregation. But he soon gave that up for a professorship in a high school where he taught Latin and history and Hebrew. However, after a short stay there, he resigned his position to study under Schleiermacher and Hegel. George Friedrich Hegel, of course, who was a famous philosopher in the 18th century, and he was they were both at Berlin, at the University of Berlin at the time, although Hegel died before he arrived there. Although he regularly attended Schleiermacher's lectures, he was interested only in those on the life of Jesus. And after a year or so there, he returned to Tübingen to lecture on logic, Plato, and the history of philosophy and ethics, with a great deal of success. He was a very intelligent man and, I guess, a very dynamic professor, a lecturer. But he soon became restless, so he resigned his position in order to devote all of his time to the completion of Leben Jesu, which means, of course, Life of Jesus in German.
In German.
Which he published in 1835 at the relative young age of 27 years of age, or old.
So he's got to be a pretty intelligent person.
Oh, sure. Rhonda Shervin and Eugene Coven, we've quoted them in some of our other sessions, they tell us in their Love of Wisdom, an introduction to Christian philosophy, that Strauss was one of the first to apply the hermeneutics of Benedict Spinoza to the New Testament by treating the supernatural aspects found in the Gospels as mythological. Remember, we had earlier in this session a little bit in our series on understanding the Bible, and also in our series on the Da Vinci Code, we talked quite a bit about Spinoza.
And his methodology was to keep questioning, and that undermine a person's faith.
Yes. They inform us that he lost his boyhood Protestant religion in his studies of Kant, Hegel, and Schleiermacher when preparing for the Protestant ministry. In other words, these are all people that we've looked at. We've looked at Immanuel Kant and how his philosophy really undermined a lot of people's faith, how Hegel and his evolutionary idea, the dialectical idealism, and then, of course, we spent quite a bit of time looking at Schleiermacher. And so Strauss, as a young man, you know, gets steeped in these philosophies, and basically he loses his faith. One scholar has said of Strauss that, imbued with the philosophical prejudice of the Spinozan metaphysics against the free, sovereign, almighty, and personal God of creation and revelation, Strauss developed his analysis of the New Testament as the faith experience of Christ by an early credulous and myth-making community of believers. This Christ of faith has little in common with the Jesus of history. It was the substance of Strauss's Life of Christ which Ernest Renan brought over into French for Catholic modernism. And we'll look at Renan and modernism in some later sessions.
Renan had a profound influence on the thinking in the Catholic world.
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, what did Strauss say in his Life of Christ that that made you lose your faith for a while?
Well, he explained every miracle of the Bible in mythological terms rather than in supernaturalistic terms. I was too young and ignorant at the time to know any better. According to Philip Trower, whom we've quoted in some of earlier in our series several times, Strauss acknowledged that there had been before him two different kinds of attempts to interpret the meaning of Jesus. The orthodox or supernatural approach started with the premise that all the scriptures contained was true. It's supernatural, that is, it's miracles and prophecies, as well as its natural elements. And from this starting point, it explained the meaning of the various books, coping it best it could with whatever apparent contradictions it met, end of quote. Then he goes on to say, quote, the natural or rational approach began with the opposite premise. Only what was historical or rationally explicable could possibly be true. Hence, only those passages allowing a rational explanation were to be considered as true. All else was to be eliminated. The rationalists tried to correct the supernaturalists by claiming...
Okay, now these are certainly startling claims, but they're still with us today. I hear them sometime, even today.
Jesus didn't walk on water, but instead merely walked along the beach or on some shallow portion of the lake. He didn't multiply the loaves and fishes, but got the crowd to share their lunches with others. He didn't cure the blind and deaf, but used special water and powder formulas. I just read quite a bit about that subject here.
I've never heard that before.
He didn't cure other diseases, which were due to psychological factors anyway, but merely suggested in a clinical manner a cure, sort of psychological thing.
Kind of hypnotist.
Yes, like they were just psychosomatically ill, you know, not really ill.
Okay.
Jesus didn't die on the cross, but merely pretended to be dead. There are a lot of different variations in every one of those. And in a class I teach on apologetics, we look at these and some others and all the different variations and refute every one of them. Something, you know, far beyond what we can do in this series, but something that, you know, that is very doable.
But these are very alive today.
Oh, sure they are.
Jesus didn't walk in the water and didn't multiply the loaves and fishes. Okay.
There's nothing new under the sun.
Okay.
Well, although rationalists believe that the supernaturalist claims of Christianity have been demolished by Strauss and other liberal Protestant biblical scholars, these and many other rationalist claims can be easily refuted, and we'll wait for another series that I'm working on right now, that we're working on right now, on what's in the Bible to try to do that. Tower says that Strauss found both of these approaches unsatisfactory. He didn't like either approach. He didn't like the naturalist approach that we just described, all those things. But he didn't like the supernatural. Obviously, didn't like the supernatural. He didn't like either one of them. He thought that they were both unsatisfactory. So instead, he proposed, in typically Hegelian style, a third method of interpretation, the mythological one, which would achieve a synthesis or a combination of the acceptable elements of the two prior types of explanation. And on this matter, one scholar has said, quote, having rejected both the rationalist and supernatural approaches, Strauss then argues for a mythological approach. And I think that I can best explain specifically what in Strauss's Life of Jesus that disturbed my faith by looking at what Marcus Borg has had to say about him. And he should know, because he lost his faith by reading such books as a young man himself. And although he is considered one of the top experts on the life of Jesus today, he really never fully regained his orthodox faith. And he is not only one of the most well-known experts on Strauss's life, Strauss's life, but a leading practitioner of this method himself. In fact, he's a prominent member of the famous or infamous Jesus' Seminar, which we will look at in some other session, but which has done so much to undermine and destroy people's faith by providing naturalistic explanations of Jesus' life and deeds. He says that, quote, what made Strauss's book so controversial was his treatment of much of the Gospels, especially the miraculous elements, as mythical in character. And to appreciate his contribution, we must set his argument in the context of theological and biblical controversies of his day, end of quote.
Ron, I think we've only got 2.5 minutes. Do you want to try to talk about the controversies of the day to understand what Strauss's interpretation of the Gospels and mythological language was?
Well, it probably wouldn't be too good an idea to get into those because it'll take us probably at least 5 minutes or so to look at these controversies. And
okay, so and we might just summarize there again. Strauss is saying, I'm not satisfied with reading the Gospel as miracles, really God's intervention.
The supernatural explanation.
Supernatural. And I'm not satisfied with these explanations that say, well, Jesus multiplied loaves and fishes by getting people to share what they had.
And that's the natural explanation.
That's the natural explanation. So he comes up with a mythological explanation.
Exactly right.
And does this with almost every incident in the Gospel.
He wrote another popular version. This first version was a real scholarly thing, big thick thing, but he wrote a more popular version, and that's probably the one I read, that much later in his life, where he also incorporates some of this liberal Protestant rationalist kind of thing in there. So I got a little bit of both of that when I read the book. So I actually hadn't read the original.
How did you get out of it? Oh, looks like we're getting the signal. How did you get out of your lack of faith, your shaking of faith? We only got 40 seconds.
Well, later on, I transferred to the Alaska, and I started going to a chapel, Catholic chapel, which was just about a half a block down from where I was stationed there, my barracks, and they had a little library there, and I started reading some of the books there, and I thought, boy, this stuff really makes a lot of sense.
Ron, I have to cut you off. To our audience, may God bless you all, always and in all ways.